So we hope that you'll join us and tune in this Friday night at 10 p.m. as we ride together and play 100% vinyl of the music that gives us life. Pull up to the station for all that and more right here on the Harlem Connection.
And it is 9 p.m. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Time now for Untitled with Malika Lee Whitney.
Everyone, thank you so much for tuning in this edition of Untitled. Kendrick Lamar, Hold Your Fire, African Film Festival, closing commentary, and so much more. But just a little bit more about the highlights. As seemingly the world knows, that Kendrick Lamar dropped The Heart Number 5, more to come. We'll play the intro at least. Stephon Forbes, repeat, Stephon Forbes and brother Shuaib Rahim called the shots about the documentary Hold Your Fire, so we'll play the trailer from that. This year marks the 29th anniversary of the New York African Film Festival screenings at Lincoln Center, Brooklyn Academy of Music, and Maisel's, not to be missed. Renowned filmmaker Haile Gerima is offering a master class on content, form, and the aesthetics of liberation. Sister Dara, who's a major, major role player in coordinating this festival, will be on with us to talk about some more of the highlights. The spring 2022 issue of African Voices magazine is online, and they're offering free copies of it. It features cover art by Sage Gallen's series, You Are Stronger Than the Storm. Poets Gloria J. Brown Marshall, you all have heard her name here and heard her on the air, will be among the poets, including Lolita Stewart White, Nadia Bongo, Quincy Troop, will drop words, all of them. And there are students from age 8 to 18 who were also contributed to the edition. Closing commentary with Professor Sam Anderson, author and mathematician. He's also an activist who just returned from Cuba. So let's hear just a little bit of the tease for Kendrick Lamar. I think the work is unique. The morphing is very touching because it reveals the images, in particular Nipsey Russell. I'm just like, yeah, it's kind of heavy, but very interesting. Creation that he and Free have put together. So listen up.
As I get a little older, I realize life is perspective. And my perspective may differ from yours. I want to say thank you to everyone that's been down with me. All my fans, all my beautiful fans. Anyone who's ever gave me a lesson. All my people.
I come from a generation of pain where murder is minor. Rebellious and more jealous, a chip you for designer. Belt buckles
and I have some theater talk to follow that. Had other plans, and plans have changed a little bit. And I'm going to read what I'm entitling Muse News. This year, a record number of black artists have been nominated for 2022 Tony Awards, including performers such as the historic nomination of the trans actor L. Morgan Lee for her work in Michael R. Jackson's Pulitzer Prize-winning musical, A Strange Loop. Other black artists were recognized for their work behind the scenes, such as Camille A. Brown, who is reportedly the first woman to be nominated as both a director and choreographer in over 60 years. However, some of the nominations and categories for which artists have been nominated are causing some to say, make it make sense. For example, why put both Felicia Rashad for Skeleton Crew and Uzu Aduba for Clyde's in the best performance by an actress in a featured role in a play, when both should have been considered leading roles, or at least they were marketed to audience members as such? Question: what is the criteria for best revival of a play and best play or best musical? Both Skeleton Crew and A Strange Loop have been produced off-Broadway, so why are they not in the revival category? Is it the time in between when they were first presented off-Broadway and then produced on Broadway? Question. Speaking of Skeleton Crew, the play's director, Ruben Santiago Hudson, was snubbed for his work on this play, but was nominated for a Tony for Best Performance by a Lead Actor in a play in his solo show, Lackawanna Blues. Why not just give Ruben Santiago Hudson a special award for Lackawanna Blues, which he deserves, hands down? Another question. No one from the two black-authored plays, Passover and Chicken and Biscuits, that helped to reopen Broadway last summer for the first time since the pandemic struck, were recognized. The American Theater Wing may be patting itself on the back about the nominations and their decision to have the openly queer, Oscar-winning, Afro-Latina actor, Ariana DeBose, to host the Tonys. But the theater wing still has a long way to go to address the true sustainability, inclusivity, and accessibility of commercial theater to marginalized people and underserved communities. Well, that is Muse News, perhaps a new feature that we'll be offering. There's some other things happening that I want to mention before we begin to churn the knobs for some of the guests that we'll be having on this evening. And among the interesting, where's that little piece of paper that has disappeared from me? Oh, the National Dance Institute is actually kicking off their appearances on the New York City Parks Department's Dance Mobile tomorrow, Saturday, May 14th. They're doing two performances in the afternoon, and the Jackie Robinson Park is located at 148th Street and Bradhurst Avenue, so that might be something you want to check out. And I also have a note here, Rise Up for Abortion Rights takes it to the streets, Union Square. That's also tomorrow, Union Square on 14th Street in Manhattan. That's at 2 o'clock, and folks will be there raising their voices high and mighty. And I just want to mention a remembrance of Michelle Mateer. It was actually streamed on Thursday the 12th. Michelle Mateer passed a few months ago, and she was professor of media studies at the New School, founder of Creatively Speaking, and a film maven, a producer, curator, and so committed to supporting makers of all stripes. So, Michelle Mateer, we remember you. So, I also want to remind once again that I did mention that there is an offer for our listeners to receive the online copy of the current online version of African Voices, and I'll share that information with you, which includes this. You can go to African Voices, magazine.com to find out more. I'm Malika Lee Whitney, so we're going to move on and start reaching out to some of the guests who decided to join us on this edition of Untitled. And I really want to thank the newsmaker for sharing the information. And do get out and see theater. And I'll have some good news about something that I'm doing tomorrow myself as well, so stay tuned. Max, I didn't drop it in, but if you need a little space to get us through the next iteration of this program, we can certainly start with the documentary. It's a trailer from film entitled Hold Your Fire. So listen up for that.
Two guys asked me to pick up something from the bottom shelf. And when I stood up, the guy had a 25 automatic. Puts it to my head. Someone outside called the cops.
Four terrorists had been surprised inside the store on Friday afternoon.
No, they didn't know who we were.
Holy crap, 12 hostages inside a sporting goods store loaded with firearms.
We opened the door. There were cops everywhere.
That's when things went haywire.
The perps certainly had evil intent. Kill the hostages. Go out in the blaze of glory.
We didn't want to go out in the blaze of glory. The hell, if you're going to execute me, and I got all these guns in here, what do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to defend myself. All my life, police was killing black people.
I know for a fact that cops aren't racist. We never discriminated against anybody.
A story of violence inside a sporting goods store in Brooklyn.
Botched robbery, killed a police officer. I don't think that they believed they could get out alive.
Bullets was flying all over the store. They wanted blood.
I was terrified. We're through.
Cops usually wind up overreacting.
Kill them all.
No.
I believe in talking.
Harvey Schlossberg. He didn't look like a cop. He didn't act like a cop.
But he had his PhD in psychology.
I believe police can influence people without bullying.
The most difficult thing in the world to change is a culture. Now we're going to talk to these individuals.
It was revolutionary. This is the birthplace of hostage negotiation. You're looking to find that key that opens that guy's head.
My mother?
Anything you can to make a conversation, you must get them to talk.
I'm trying to figure out a way to end this thing.
The crowd got out of hand.
You might have a massacre in your hands.
Nobody really knows what the next move is going to be.
Just give me a reason to kill you.
Oh, my God.
I want him out alive.
What I'm about to share is taking from the film descriptive. In 1973, four young African-American men stealing guns for self-defense in Brooklyn were cornered by NYPD. A violent gun battle killed a police officer, and it began the longest hostage siege in NYPD history. The NYPD's 130-year-old policy was to deliver an ultimatum, then respond with deadly force. Could visionary police psychologist Harvey Schlossberg convince his superiors to do the unthinkable, negotiate with quote-unquote criminals, and save 12 hostages from an impending bloodbath? It is never before film. Gripping interviews with survivors. Hold Your Fire uncovers what really happened in this landmark event with the potential to revolutionize American policing. Who do I have on the line? Good evening.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. I take it Stefan and Brother Rahim are with us, so thank you both so much. I'd like to begin with you, Stefan, to share with us, there must be something about this major headliner that had you turning the pages back in time to document this incident in another way. So tell us the why.
Yeah, you know, I'm a huge fan of all these classic, gritty American films from the 1970s, French Connection, Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico. You know, that's what all I knew of New York before I moved here. Gritty, multicultural Brooklyn, violent, you know, guns, drama. And those movies were made by some of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And when I uncovered this story, I was like, could we make a movie like that? A 70s story with the cultural realness and the truth, but actually tell it in a 2020 style, letting different voices be heard, speaking to all players.
You had to propose this. So usually credits are given on the back end, but I want to make sure we get it in because the clock ticks so quickly when we're in front of our listeners. So please, let's give some key folks. Of course, we have Brother Rahim, on the line as well. But we want to make sure that we give a shout-out and holler. Of course, you as director, cinematographer, writer, you did a lot. So tell us about some of the other folks who had a hand in this, and then we'll pose a few questions to Brother Rahim.
Of course, Fab Five Freddy. You know, New York City legend, who's an old friend of mine, who I had to call on him. You know, how do we let these other voices be heard? How do we delve into the community, into how the people in the neighborhood felt during this siege with 1,000 cops on their streets? As, you know, we see in the film, there was violence threatened at all times. There's pretty much a riot there. I needed to track down the hostages, uncover their trauma. I spoke to the gunman. I had to travel up to Attica, you know, speak to Dawood Rahman. I wanted to hear from everyone, not just the cops. I didn't want to make the 70s cop movie. I wanted to make a 2020s movie, relying on a lot of different people to get other voices heard this time. And
well, speaking of other voices, let me jump in and let's hear from one who was there. That's not often the case, especially given the time frame. So welcome once again, and I really take great pride and pleasure in having the opportunity to connect with you, but you definitely can give a first-hand account. But more importantly, and I think equally beneficial for listeners to hear, is your life now. But just if you would speak to Stefan's enthusiasm to do this and why you decided to sign on.
Hello. My name is Shuaib, pronounced Shuaib Abdul Rahim. And so Stefan approached me about 7 years ago. He has sought me out. Actually, he had been referred to me by my co-defendant at the time, Dawood, who was still in Elmira. And he sent him to see me because he was unable to speak freely about the incident. It took me some while to be comfortable speaking to Stefan. You know, of course, I didn't know what his intent was, why he wanted to do the documentary, but he convinced me that he was going to make a fair presentation of it. I built a trusting relationship with him over 7 years and multiple filmings, conversations, recordings here and there to bring out this story. I was amazed at the final product that it did bring together this conversation, as he used to describe it to me, what his intent was, where different voices are speaking to an incident from different angles, and to present to the world the truth about what happened during that incident at John and Al's Sporting Goods store back in January 19th to the 21st of 1973. So those a few days were, unfortunately for me, the worst days of my life, the worst decision ever made in my life, all for the right reasons. But as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and good intentions are not enough. You have to still do things right. I made a terrible decision to obtain guns in a way, in an illegal way, to protect myself and my family, our community, from a real and present danger and threat that had manifested itself the day before with the massacre of seven family members in a masjid in Washington, D.C., a mosque that had been formerly owned by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who had donated to the community. And there was a conflict between the leader there and a former member of the Nation of Islam who had become critical of Elijah Muhammad. And that was the result. They came there to kill him. He wasn't home, so they massacred his entire family. you know, two women and five children. We heard about it in New York. We had similar problems with them, myself personally. That led to me trying to obtain weapons to defend myself as well as the community from what we felt was an imminent danger. And that was what caused it.
Allow me. I must mention the letters BLM strikes all kinds of emotions and thoughts to the mind, and the letters standing for the Black Liberation Army. Were the actions exclusively directed under that organization or independently?
It had nothing to do with the Black Liberation Army at all. That was what they assumed we were because of the nature of the offense during the time frame when the BLA was engaged in combat with the police nationwide. And they assumed because we were getting weapons and we exchanged gunfire with the police that we were of them. And it took them a couple of days to realize that we weren't members of the BLA. The incident had absolutely nothing to do with the goals, objectives, or the operatives of the BLA.
That clarification is certainly welcome. And often, you know, when history is being told, there are many versions of it. So it's better to hear the truth from those who know. Returning to you, Stefan, any concerns about the possibility of leaning toward those who, quote unquote, perpetrated the acts? Are you concerned that might be thought in the minds of some who watch the film? Not necessarily mine, but, you know, there's talk.
Yeah, you know, great question. Every filmmaker has a perspective, you know. No one's object. I believe the idea of objectivity in the media is oftentimes you're ignoring the fact that it has corporate owners and that, you know, everyone has a slant. But my goal is always to let everyone tell their story. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that not only did I make a space for Shuaib, and his co-defendants to trust me, I made a space for the hostages to tell a radically different story than they had told in the press, where their appearances were stage managed by the PDA, the Patrolmen's Union. So you didn't really hear from these people about how they truly felt. I thought they hated Shuaib. They expressed empathy and compassion in interviews, and some of their family members were worried that they seemed too, quote, pro-criminal, that they'd get criticized. And lastly, it's a great question because I also am proud that I let the police officers speak from the heart. There's super disturbing things that they say that expose, you know, education is needed among the police department, but they also express radical critiques of policing in America and of their own actions in the NYPD. So you got to let cops talk too. You got to see them as human beings, and you're surprised by what you might hear once you are able to break that blue wall of silence.
Please speak about Harvey Schlossberg and his recommendation for quelling what was going on.
Harvey believed that life is a crucial thing. He believed violence doesn't solve problems. And that was radical in an authoritarian top-down institution like the NYPD to have a 99-pound intellectual Jewish PhD preaching radical empathy to them. And everything about his approach undid the patriarchal white man violence that so many of us are socialized with in this country, even people in the hood. We've inherited the American notion of toxic masculinity that to solve things with violence is the way a man does it, that we must dominate every interaction, and that, you know, to be vulnerable, to express pain or even fear is effeminate. And what we see in so many of these killings, there's one out that Sean King posted yesterday. The cop is screaming at this lady holding a knife. He feels the need to dominate her. And he's obviously terrified at any loss of control over that situation. That's a false notion of policing. And Harvey critique that from the inside. He was a revolutionary figure. There are people trying to follow in his footsteps today, but they need help. They need funding. And we believe, as the filmmakers, that every law enforcement officer in America deserves this training in conflict resolution and de-escalation. It's a no-brainer. It keeps cops safe. It keeps our community safe. And when people see this film, Hold Your Fire, at holdyourfiredoc.com, you can check out the trailer. Hopefully we can get a groundswell going to demand this training to keep our communities safe.
That and so much more. I wanted to ask Brother Rahim to speak to the moment when, I don't want to give too much away because it's such an engrossing film, it's better seen, through the eyes of our listeners who have not as yet. But certainly there was a bullhorn and the voice, a recognizable voice came on at the time this incident was in progress. Would you address that?
Yes, that voice was my mother. May God bless her soul. She was, they had contacted her, or actually she contacted them, realizing that I was probably one of the people inside of the store. And they put her inside this armored personnel carrier, a tank, drove up to the store, and she was trying to use her to lure me out, lure us out without any guarantees of our safety. She meant well, but hearing her voice really shocked me. And years later, hearing it on film, repeated, I've seen the film a few times, and just hearing her voice, it's like it just gives me chills, man. I mean, she was a great woman, fantastic mother, very proactive, one of Shirley Chisholm's close aides, and very proactive in the communities, organized the parent-teachers movement against Ocean Hill Brownsville, the school takeover of by the community, and also, spread my whole life in terms of me becoming more proactive in the community. These are things that preceded this incident, so I don't even want to go deep into that. That's my life, my background, with somebody before all this happened and somebody afterwards too. But, that voice was my mom, and it really sent chills down my spine to hear her voice again today, because she passed away in August of 1980.
Now, the film was given a screening just a couple of days ago, I'm told. Rooftop Films, were you attending that?
Yes, ma'am. I was there.
So I'm just curious, from your observation, what kind of responses were you receiving? I'm sure folks were approaching you with some commentary or inquiry.
It was overwhelmingly positive, supportive, inspirational. People were moved by the documentary, the story. It's historical, it's accurate, and it resonated with everyone in the community. Everyone who observed it, that approached me, had nothing but good and positive things to say about the film. And of course, more than anything, about my story, because it comes out there, where I was at that point and where I am today and things I'm doing now as opposed to then, as well as my co-defendant, Daoud, who was also depicted in the documentary. And so they were very supportive. Some people asked us to ask me.
I have read some of the reviews, and they are absolutely astounding. Stefan, we're going to close shortly, but not before we give information about where the film can be seen. And one brief response, if you will, is it being screened for any other departments that are governing our city and state that might benefit from it, in your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on. The film can be seen at the IFC Center in New York. We're opening on the 20th, next Friday. And anywhere you rent your movies, Amazon, iTunes, it's on the VOD channels as well. We've had an incredible response from a lot of the city government. Commissioner Bratton invited me into the NYPD to interview people and to tell the story. But it's hard for the NYPD to take a proactive stance. A lot of cops have told me they love it, but they can't really say, hey, we need to change up the way we do things. The commissions, probations wants to work with this film. People throughout government, we're talking to mayors in New York and New Jersey. People welcome this film because it saves lives. And, you know, hostage negotiation is a win for the cops. People love seeing the negotiation teams come in, but every cop needs this training. And that's a revolution in American policing that Harvey Schlossberg tried to start. He saved thousands of lives, tens of thousands around the world. It's a tragedy that in America, we don't heed his call. And this film, we urge people to share it so we can open hearts and minds. And there's been a solution for 50 years while people in our communities are dying, and we're excited to get that solution out there.
Well, thank you so much for the work. Thank you both. It's much appreciated. I certainly wish we had a lot more time to discuss it, but I hope this conversation will be an incentive for folks to hold your fire on their list of things to do and see. Thank you both so very much for participating in this broadcast, and hopefully the airwaves will continue to be available for further discussion. So thank you so much, and wish you the best, because success is obviously in line and something that can be beneficial, not just here, but worldwide. Appreciate you. Thank you both. WBAI New York, I'm Malika Lee Whitney. The program is Untitled. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, non-corporate, WBAI.org, and we're streaming on the World Wide Web. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about the 29th celebratory New York African Film Festival coming up, but this time a clip that I'm sure a lot of listeners will find interesting because it has everything to do with the East. Stay tuned.
Well, I felt I was part of the freedom struggle of black people. I was part of the ongoing struggle of the black community to establish itself, to obtain self-determination, to obtain dignity, and to obtain liberation.
We are the original Wakanda children.
The idea that we could bring the greatest musicians in the world to the East and that they would perform in Bedford-Stuyvesant to right here was something that was unique.
Nation building, of course, has to be built on institutions.
Then we had our food store.
Kanunawana Food Cooperative.
Black News newspaper.
Out of Black News, there became a publishing company called East Publishers.
Babazi Clothing Shop.
East Records.
We had a bookstore. The bookstore was called Akiba M. Koo.
East Kitchen and Caterers.
Sweet East Restaurant.
Imani Child Development Center. Evening School of Knowledge.
The International African Arts Festival.
The East was filled with youthful exuberance. All young people were basically very, very gung-ho.
For me, I could say I was almost born again as a black man at the East.
It was about building that self-esteem in us to be who we are as an African people and know that we have a right to be here.
And so was it able to, you know, bring us to the promised land? No, of course not. Did it take us a few steps toward that and our liberation? Hell yes.
Dara?
Sister Malika, hello. How are you?
Sister Dara Ojibele, thank you so much for joining us. For our listeners, the East registers in so many lives, and a Brooklyn-based piece is a wonderful addition to this year's 29. Imagine that. We're so young still. So yeah. You can say that for yourself. So Dara plays a major role in making this happen, of course. Founder, executive directors, Mahen Bonetti, and the curatorial work that goes into bringing this massive amount of films representative of so many places is just nothing short of astonishing. I'd like to start by asking you, what's the name of this year's theme? As if I don't know, but go ahead.
So first off, thank you so much, Sister Malika, for having me. And yeah, this year's festival is being presented under the banner Visions of Freedom.
Perfect title. Yes. Speak to some of the components that I know include, because I'm holding the program materials in front of me, art and activism, digital art, and then we'll go in a little bit. So just some of the countries represented, because we'd be on the phone until midnight talking about all the films. But let's speak about the components and the content.
Yeah, so, I mean, we really wanted to just address this theme from different perspectives from throughout Africa and the diaspora. So we have films from Tanzania, we have films from the Congo / Belgium, Nigeria, Haiti, we have films, of course, from the U.S., all over, South Africa, that are just different perspectives on what it means to be free in this time in the world. So
one of the highlights that really drew my attention is the fact that you have the renowned, worldly, popular, and highly respected Ethiopian doing a masterclass. So let's name him and talk about when it is and where it is.
Yes,
Haile Gerima.
Yes, we are so excited about that. And that's taking place tomorrow morning, 11:30 a.m. at the Amphitheater at Film at Lincoln Center. And it's going to focus on the cinema of liberation and how we as audiences can participate in liberation through cinema and building audiences for liberation cinema. So that is what Haile's class will focus on. And he'll be sharing clips from his films and talking about his process and his creative journey. So we're very excited about that.
Including all the aesthetics of filmmaking. So being able to get that kind of information from a master, I think, is something not to be missed. The opening film, which I actually attended, Frida, was absolutely fascinating. So can you speak a little bit about the choice of that as the big bumper for the festival?
So
all the films are worthy and certainly needing of eyes on the screens. But let's talk about that film briefly.
Yeah, so Frida is a big one from Haiti, and it was brought to our attention from a friend of AFF, and it received so much acclaim from the biggest of the highest names in film, and just focuses on this family in Haiti and their perseverance in that, like, for us, is the epitome of freedom and, you know, just navigating the craziness of life together as a unit, and just making sure that stays together. So that was why it was important for us to present that as the opening night film. And it was by a woman, and she's an actress and also a promising director. The film was actually also Haiti's submission to the Oscars for 2021. So it was really a big and important one to show and open the festival off with a bang. So that's why we chose it. Yeah.
So their features, narratives, and shorts. Did I leave out any genre?
There's features.
And are there any
shorts,
films for young audiences on this year?
Yes. So we have quite a bit of animation actually this year, sort of spread out through the festival. We have a short animation about the legacy of Shaka Zulu, which is playing on Sunday with a documentary about the filmmaker Abderrahmane Sissoko, who is directed his first opera, and that opera is about the history of Africa. So we thought it would be good to pair those two things together And we also have an animation about AI and algorithms, which is actually playing tonight in the New York Shorts program. We have, just all types of subject matter just through animation this year. So that's also really great. We have a program actually that's a feature film from Senegal. It's called A Child's Love Story, and that's going to be playing at BAM on Sunday. Let me just get the date quickly. Sunday, May 29th at 2 p.m., and it talks about love from a child's perspective. So that's also one for family.
So the having this series of film screenings, you know, moving around the boroughs kind of is really special, and it creates a lot more access. So if you would be so kind as to just mention the dates when each cycle of the films is being shown, like we already mentioned that it began at Lincoln Center, so the From To dates for each.
So we began at the Lincoln Center last night, and we'll be here through May 17th, and then we'll be going over to Maisel Cinema in Harlem from the 19th to the 22nd, and then we'll be at BAM in Brooklyn from May 27th to June 2nd.
So could you be a little bit specific about your exact role in the organizing and curating? You'll probably leave some things out because you're so humble. But brag. You can brag on this program.
My official title is program manager. I've been with AFF for about 8 years now. I started as a volunteer / intern, and it's just such a special place that I stuck around as my love and passion for cinema and filmmaking has grown. But I wear many different hats under that title. I do programming, I do administrative work, I do editing, I do help with social media, I help with some of the education programs and community programming in the park, I help manage the website, the list can kind of
It's a long list. I've seen you in action, so I just think, why not mention it? So once again, we really have to give kudos to Sister Mahen Bonetti, who has really done an amazing job, you know, like being the captainess of this year's ship, you know, and the anchors are away, you know, once things kick off because it's busy. Mm-hmm. And the organization does other programming throughout the year, so we want to mention that as well, you know, things happening in outdoor spaces. I don't anticipate that you'll have all the dates and information about that, but at least you can speak to that event coming up as well as the fun things that happen on Governor's Island. So if you take a moment just to flip through that a bit.
So as soon as the festival is over, I mean, even the next day we have a co-presentation with them on the June 3rd, a film by Saul Williams and Anicia Uzeman, Neptune Frost. And then we'll be in the parks throughout June, July, August, September, where we do Kid Flicks with Mokada. And throughout August, we have Governor's Island Family Day celebration, as you mentioned, which will be mid to late September. There's going to be a lot of great outdoor screenings. So that can all be, all the information will be able to be found on our website, africanfilmny.org.
So the voice of Sister Dara, who I gave a long list of things that she does. Are there some other folks we should thank for organizing? There's so many, you know, but the administrative and whom I've met that are in the office now, like just maybe at this moment, but they may be at the venue, know, greeting people. It's just comfortable. And I, on occasion, I must say, for transparency's sake, that I have the occasion every now and again to moderate and do Q&As after the film, so I am connected.
Yes.
You know.
Wonderful. Right?
This is a real special opportunity. It feels like you're traveling miles and miles and miles away, visiting all these countries and learning mm-hmm. about the people who are connected to us, and especially in a liberating way. So before we close, please give the coordinates, the special way that folks can go online. And there are some visual things, I think, happening
that
folks can watch.
So we have the digital art exhibition is actually playing here. It's by an artist, Nigerian-American artist named Zainab Aliyu. And it'll be playing as a free event that's playing in the amphitheater here at Lincoln Center, so in between screenings. And it also ties into the theme. She actually coded a liberation song. She coded, you know, computer coded that plays on the screen throughout the day. So that's free to come and see. And I just wanted to quickly shout out the rest of the team. Of course, Mahen Bonetti, our leader, fearless leader, Farima Konekito, who is our festival manager, Fred Zukule, who's our festival coordinator, and of course our volunteer team, our consultants. Just so much passion goes into, you know, doing this event each year. So we're very grateful to everyone. And of course, information can be found at africanfilmny.org.
All the heads of the organizations, and I got to give a special thank you to Cheryl Duncan, PR, who always hooks things up and lets the world know what we're doing. Thank you so much, Dara. I look forward to seeing you soon. Much appreciation. And just know that this particular event, whether or not I was directly connected to it, has a special place in my heart. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Get some rest if you dare do that.
Yes, we'll do.
Take care.
Right. See you soon. Bye.
Peace and blessings to you. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. And I didn't say it, Max, but if you need a little transitional music, we can always go to Kevin, and I will repeat maybe one or two pieces of information relative to what was played already. So while I'm babbling, you need some dial-up music. So here we go. Sounds to dial up by. So I am so grateful to the guests who talked about the film Hold Your Fire. Remember, it is available for seeing at the IFC Center. And Max, Sam Anderson has the number, so he may be calling in.
He's already
on the line. I will cease chatting. Sam Anderson, I've been told kind of in a way subtly what to do, and that is be quiet and just say hello. Mathematician, author, activist, global traveler. You've been somewhere recently. Take it away.
How you doing, my sister? Yes, I have. My wife, Rosemary Mealy, and I have been in Cuba in April through May Day. And a little bit beyond, and it was as always a very revealing educational experience being in Cuba under 60 plus years of the U.S. blockade, and the Cubans just saying, "You got a blockade against us? We're going to find ways of dealing with everything in our society."
Was there a particular series of events happening that drew you there this time? I know it's not a first.
Well, not really. We wanted to be part of the May Day event, particularly coming out of the pandemic. They didn't have May Day last year in the way that they did it this year. The major event, unfortunately, was 500 miles away from where we were. We were in Havana. And the major May Day event was in Santiago, which is the eastern end of the Cuban island. But the turnout for Havana was really phenomenal. Some nearly 700,000 people turned out, which is the vast. Like the vast majority of Havana and the provinces around Havana, and they turned out in all of their various labor categories. The first category that came past the viewing stand was the medical, everything that deal with the medical reality, because they're very proud that 96% of Cubans from the age of 2 years up to 109 have been vaccinated, and with their own vaccine that they had to create because the U.S. blockade did not allow for Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson to have any dealings with vaccinating Cuban people. So they created their own, to make a long story short. Mm. There's a lot to that, and I wish we'd have more time to spend on that. But they were very, very successful in creating five vaccines, and the major vaccine that they created was called Abdala, that they were very proud of that. And so the first part of the May Day March was all of the people who were involved in the area of medical, pharmaceutical, and so forth. And that took 20 minutes to march past the viewing stand. that was a lot of people, a whole lot of people. And it ended with the young people, with high school and middle school students in the end of the march, pointing out symbolically that they're the future of progress in the Cuban society. And that was just Havana, but you had various across the island, various marches, May Day marches. Like I said, the major one where Diaz-Canal, the president, was at Santiago. And the phenomenal thing is to show the discipline of the people, we had to get up and out at 4 o'clock in the morning to try to get to the viewing stands with other international solidarity people at 4 o'clock in the morning, because the march starts at 7. It started at 7 all across the country. It started at 7 a.m. Mm. And so it was a lot of work. It's not like, in the U.S. you can get a cab or catch a subway or a bus to get from point A to point B. So, many people had that capability, but it was very, very difficult because of the blockade that doesn't allow oftentimes Venezuelan oil to come into Cuba to deal with the fuel situation and the diesel and the gas and so forth. So it was complicated. So, most people in Havana walked to the event, and by walking, meaning it's like for many people walking from, let's say, Co-op City in the Bronx to 125th Street in Harlem, walking that distance, to get there, to get to the event. And so that was very determined. And the other thing that I felt that was very impressive was we had a chance to visit the Fidel Center in Havana, which is they took over an old classic estate with about an acre of grounds around it in Havana, and rebuilt it, remodeled it, and restored it to its 1920s splendor and so forth, and made it into a center, a digital centered, interactive center for the life and times of Fidel Castro. And it was open. It's open to the public. You don't pay to get in. And they have these tours, and we spontaneously arrived. And so we had to wait for a critical mass of people to come with us for the tour. And the tour is about maybe about 2 hours in this building. And there's a lot of stuff, very, very well organized. And a lot of young people are the guides to the tours. And it's very informative, very moving and very informative.
This, you know, like all of my segments, this certainly warrants a lot more discussion. The only headline about anything that I saw, and you'll have to wrap this up in a minute or so, was the fire to a historic building. But nothing about the significance and importance of how they...
The explosion at the Saratoga Hotel, which is across, literally across the street from the Capitol, and also coincidentally 3 blocks from where we were staying, that was a real devastation. The explosion was an accident because of the way gas was being transferred into the Saratoga, which they were just finishing up on the restoration of the hotel, you know, because of COVID. A lot of tourists didn't show, so they decided to just do a restoration like with many of the hotels.
Sam Anderson, your gifts of voice and insights is always welcome here, and look forward to another call for part two, because I'd certainly like to hear more, especially the strong efforts for the Cuban people to, you know, be of themselves and it takes.
Before I go, there were a large contingent from across the world in solidarity with Cuba at the conference in Havana, International Solidarity Conference.
Didn't make the news. What can I tell you?
No, not here.
Didn't make the news. Well, it's a wrap for me this evening, and thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Hope I get another chance to go. I'm happy that I did get to get there. Is that a sentence? Anyway, this is the end of my sentences for this evening. I'm Malika Lee Whitney. The program is Untitled. Thank you to all our guests. I hope you will check out some of the information that's shared with you. Thank you, Max Schmid on the ones and twos. Yes, we still say that. WBAI New York, WBAI.org. Take care. Peace out. Need I say more? Guess Max is tooling up something. That means I could have had another minute with Sam. Oh, well. Out we go.
The value of this radio station in a time like this cannot be overstated. Our progressive programming, covering arts and culture, public affairs, social and political issues, means so much to many. And that includes you, right? Support WBAI to ensure our impact and continued longevity for a time like this.
Peace, peace, y'all. I'm BrewX Boogie, representing Bronx-based DJ Collective, Uptown Vinyl Supreme. And every Friday on this station, the Harlem Connection celebrates artists and genres that helped establish Harlem as a cultural mecca. But this week is Bronx Week, and my Uptown Vinyl Supreme crew has been invited to come on board as guest musical conductors. So we hope that you'll join us and tune in this Friday night at 10 p.m. as we ride together and play 100% vinyl of the music that gives us life. Pull up to the station for all that and more right here on the Harlem Connection.
I believe
that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive